this could be BBC scream and noise kind of thing.
Yeah, just remember that.
I've just given everyone the idea of sending that as a voice note, by the way. Please don't do that.
087 9 180 180.
9:42, you're with us here on Off the Ball Breakfast. We're going in touch later today because you'll have seen over the course of the weekend a Sunday Independent and RTE joint investigation into the alleged unwanted or inappropriate sexual advances from FAI coaches throughout the 1990s. And yesterday, the FAI took the measure of apologising to the former players and trainees on a training course as well. We had FAI Interim CEO David Carell and FAI People and Culture Director Aoife Rafferty speaking at Abbottstown yesterday, and we can bring you a little bit of that apology right now.
We asked you here because we want to directly address the allegations of historical abuse of women involved in Irish football in the 1990s. It was harrowing for me in a position of leadership of the association, as a coach in my local club, and as a parent, to hear these incredibly courageous women recount their experiences last night. I'm angry to hear that these women could have had these experiences in football. The board and the executive of the FAI are deeply shocked and appalled by these revelations. I can assure you that providing a safe environment for all involved in Irish football is our paramount consideration. These matters first came to our attention in early 2024. While we sought guidance from the authorities, we also acted swiftly in seeking an opportunity to sit with the women so that we can ensure we put them at the centre of our response.
Yeah, that's some of what David Carell had to say at Abbottstown yesterday. I'm delighted to welcome Ciara McCormack, who's CEO of Treaty United, to studio. Ciara, very good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I should also introduce you as somebody who has helped to lift the lid on abuse in Canadian soccer as well. And we've spoken to you about that in the past on the show. And I think it's important to give that context in terms of what we want to speak to you about this morning. And just first of all, that apology from the FAI, acknowledging it, less than 24 hours after the programme was broadcast on RTE on Sunday night. From a whistleblower's standpoint, how important was that yesterday?
Yeah, I think that's a piece of it that maybe people that haven't been through something like it wouldn't maybe understand the
It's all good. Take your time.
Yeah, that piece of it's really important. Because I think when those sorts of things happen, I think it's just the institutional response is so important. And I think we didn't have that in Canada. We had a fight for 2.5 years to even get acknowledged. So, I really think from a victim perspective, it was a great thing to see.
It's so true. We can take a break at any point if you like here. And we really appreciate you coming on to talk about this, because as I say, it is that context, this huge part of your life that you bring to Irish football, which you're now involved in right now, which is why we just thought it was such, to get your insights would be so valuable on this. And it is so important that you do point out that none of us have any idea. The vast majority of people have no idea of how important that is to hear that. But for those people who so bravely spoke up in the publication on Sunday morning and on Sunday night in the documentary, just to see that, it may seem like platitudes to some people who have no idea what this is like, but to actually see the organisation for one second not think about what the implications might be of admitting potential culpability here or even just apologising, that sort of slight bravery, for lack of a better phrase, on the FAI's part is something that might be slightly refreshing and a slight bam for the people who've come forward to hear.
Yeah, and to be honest, for someone, again, like me that's been through a, you know, close version of the situation, I think it made me very proud to be a part of Irish football, and it made me, you know, I think this is a real opportunity to be a world leader, because I do think that so often organizations cause further harm to victims that come forward by not taking responsibility. And I think when something's happened, like, that's really all you want is that validation that what you experienced was horrible and just a genuine apology. And I definitely think the FAI got that right the other day.
What is the next thing that needs to happen from their perspective? Is an apology enough? Is it very defined and noticeable action that now needs to happen to almost justify the apology?
I mean, I think when you, you know, and again, obviously I'm not speaking for anybody that came forward in it, but I mean, I can just speak for my own personal experience. And I was a bystander and a whistleblower. It didn't happen to me. But I think when you speak up in a situation, you know, you do it because you want positive change moving forward, and you do want something to happen so that you know that, you know, what you've been through has a sense of purpose. And I think that, you know, I think the best thing that could come out of the situation would be, again, that that actual tangible change comes from it. And you know, again, I think, you know, myself even running a club, you know, obviously, and again, I'm obviously probably a lot more aware of sort of the safe sport aspect of it from having gone through it myself. But I just think it is a real opportunity here to really nail down, like, what does a safe environment look like, and to really set, you know, firm parameters around that. And I, again, I do think the FAI, from what I've seen and the people that I've spoken to, like, are starting to take steps around getting those parameters right. And I think, again, for people that come forward, like I said, I think you just want to know that it's not going to happen again. And you want to know that your pain has purpose.
And that is the chunk of what I do want to chat to you about. But just on one last point about, I guess, connected to your own experience, the point, as you say, of being a bystander and somebody who listens to the people who suffered these experiences. One of the really striking things from the reporting on Sunday was this admission from the FAI, most notably the former CEO, Bernard O'Byrne, who basically said that women's football was an afterthought within the association. And there is the sort of idea that there wasn't as much investment of resources into it, and therefore there wasn't as much of a safeguarding culture around it because nobody cared enough about the sport. Mm-hmm. It does just make you think about the people who have stepped forward, though, and the lack of bystanders that they would have had, mm-hmm. that maybe the Canadian women had in your experience, that there were such islands in this, and there was such a hopelessness to it that it has taken 30 odd years for any sort of reconciliation to happen on this.
I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. I think Canada was in exactly the same boat in the sense right. that women's soccer, I think, around the world up to the last 5 years has been an absolute afterthought. And I think that people going through horrendous situations were, you know, none of us had resources or, you know, so I don't think that that's an Ireland or Irish football specific situation. I think it's really important to note as well. I think one thing that really struck me in the documentary, and again, maybe because just of my own experience, you know, again, Olivia O'Toole, I played with her. Obviously, I played for Ireland, and so I kind of came in the generation, I guess, after what was reported. But, you know, what I was just so disgusted by was, again, the fact, obviously, she was a bystander and was an outspoken bystander. And I think, again, she's like an icon of Irish football. And the fact that she lost 2 years of her international career over this. And then, you know, the one thing, again, that I found so striking in the documentary was the, you know, the quote unquote alleged perpetrator having the audacity to say that it was because she missed training, that's why, you know, and so I just think, again, you know, I think it's also really important to acknowledge the harm, you know, done to bystanders and whistleblowers, and the, you know, just when you're putting players in a position to have to, you know, step up, like, that's a hard position to be in. So I think anything that moving forward we can do to develop situations, so, you know, if someone does come forward, that there are resources and there are people that are there, so it's not such a, you know, you're not ever in a position of losing years or getting retaliated against, because that was a big part of my experience, was the retaliation when you are someone that speaks up in these situations where these people have absolute power. And I think the more that we can eliminate that type of scenario, I just think, again, the safer we're going to make sport moving forward.
Has your general instinct been, since you've taken up the role with Treaty United and since you've been based underground here, that the culture has vastly, vastly changed?
I think the biggest thing, and again, I don't think that this is an Ireland specific problem. I know it's not. I've been so deeply, you know, involved in the safe sports space since I came forward 5 years ago with, you know, and again, have friends around the world now in different sports and genders and all that from just the experience. I mean, yeah, I do think things have changed in a sense that I do think that I mean, I just don't think that we were so on our own like 15 or 20 years ago. I think there's more of a culture. Like I know for me, even within my own experience in the last 5 years, like I learned the meaning of words like grooming and neglect and like just vocabulary to identify things that are not right. Like I don't even think we had that. So I think that's a big positive. I think people now are a lot more aware where like they'll speak up quicker if they see something. And I think now also, you know, people that choose to not take action when they're aware in these situations are seeing that there are consequences for those people as well. So unfortunately, not everybody's going to do the right thing to do the right thing, but they'll do the right thing if they know that there's consequences towards themselves or their careers. And so I think those are sorts of things that are definitely, you know, things that have changed the culture around it. I don't think it's perfect at all. I definitely think that there's still tons and tons of space to grow. But, you know, when you look at where it was 15 or 20 years ago and where it is now, like if I had a kid in sport, I'd feel better. I wouldn't feel like, you know, let them run off and not pay attention. But I do think that there's been positive change, but there's a lot more room to grow.
What would you like to see? Or how do we do that? How do we grow?
I mean, I think that there should be education around, again, I think the more that like children and, you know, teenagers and even, you know, like adults as well, like are aware of, you know, power imbalances, like what does that mean? What does that look like? Words like grooming, neglect, like that's retaliation. That's something that, you know, within my own experience, like I just thought I've always been outspoken and I just, you know, I got retaliated against often and just thought that was a consequence of my personality. Like, so I think that is an important first step that, again, you know, clubs, like that there's some kind of an education program so kids know what it's supposed to look like. And then I do think the hotline that the FAI put forward, the Raise a Concern, the, you know, anonymous type of a hotline, you know, I think that's a really important development in the sense that, you know, again, I've said this from when I first came forward. I just want it to be that if a 16-year-old is in a position that they don't feel comfortable, that A, they know what it looks like, B, they know where to go, C, they have support after they come forward. I think those three things are really important things that I think we need to start making, you know, part and parcel around, you know, the licensing process. And then things like there should be absolutely no player-coach relationships at all. Like that should just be a flat-out just culture change. And again, talking about the bravery, like I don't think a lot of associations have the bravery to make bold statements like that. But I think like everybody knows that that's the place where like issues can come from. And if it's not even an option, if it's completely off the table, if everybody knows that it's wrong, I think, again, that makes environments safer. And, you know, so I think those are some things, again, from my own experience and witnessing, you know, just again, just, I think in every soccer environment, like I said, it's not just like a Ireland specific one. Those things would make it better.
And I do think that that is going to be one of the big things that's going to be spoken about over the next little while is the player coach relationships piece in this, because there is a disconnect between the rules that exist with the national team and the rules that exist with regards to women's league football and club football in this country. And actually, that was something that was asked at the press conference of David Carell yesterday. Have a listen.
Is it important that the FAI does create regulations around this and police it?
Yes, it is. And as mentioned earlier, we have been very clear for some time about best practice in this space. In time, we are looking at introducing it as a hard and fast rule through our club licensing structures. But as for now, we have been able to communicate very clearly to all clubs that best practice is no relationship should exist between player and coach. With that said, it's up to clubs to interpret that on a local basis.
It's probably not good enough for clubs to have to interpret it and be given best practice. This needs to be put into the actual written rules, right?
That's what I believe. I think it would just make it a lot easier if that was just in a, you know, Irish football says that this is a hard and fast rule through and through, and then there's no discrepancies, there's no confusion, there's no, oh, I didn't know, or there's no a club saying, you know, for whatever reason, we're not going to buy into this. So that's my personal opinion. If it was put to our club, you know, did we agree with this and should this be a part of licensing? 100%, we would say yes. And I do believe that, I just think on a common sense level, and when you apply it to workspaces or, again, even the national team and these sorts of things, like those, that idea is there for a reason. And so I would think that if that was put to the clubs, I would think that that would be something that most if not all, would agree that is a really important next step to take out of this.
And the reason, obviously, is because of the power dynamic. And I do wonder, like, to what level does consent get completely diminished when you do have that power dynamic of a coach and a player? And I think it was Richie Sadler who was making the point in the documentary that you become increasingly vulnerable in that position where a relationship is trying to be instigated by somebody who is in, quote unquote, a position of power over you in a sporting setup.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for sure that's the first thing. Like, absolutely, there's a power dynamic there, you know. And I think the second thing as well, just even if it, let's just say, is a healthy relationship or it came from, you know, before they joined a team or whatever, like, it's gonna change a we want professional environments, you know. And when I say, again, as an athlete, even as like a serious elite high school player that, you know, is giving up a lot to, you know, and this is what their dream is and this is what they're, you want to remove all sorts of bias. And I think that when you have that sort of player coach relationship, there's always going to be a bias. And I think that, again, on a professionalism perspective, when people are trying to reach, you know, the next level or whatever, like I said, even if it was a positive relationship, that bias will exist. And I just think, again, as athletes, you just want to be treated fairly. And I think even that perception of fairness is super important, and taking any of those sorts of potential issues out of it, I think is really, really important. And I think it just causes a lot of issues that shouldn't be there in the environments we're trying to create.
What's been your experience in this space since you've been involved with Treaty? Was there already a framework, for example, when you came into the club? Is this something now that, because of this, I guess, which is not necessarily a bad thing, it's going to be something that needs to be made more of an effort and steps need to be taken over the next little while? So what's this world been like since you've come in?
I mean, I think, and I'll be very honest, like, I think a lot of safeguarding in some sense is box checking and again, even having boxes to check is a positive thing, right? But when I'm looking at it as, you know, and like I said, I've obviously been very deep in the space and I can see holes very quickly. Like, you know, one thing, again, and I give credit in the sense that there is a definite, genuine effort being made for sure. But like, as an example, let's say with a safeguarding officer at a club, awesome concept, you know, great. We have one at our club. But I think, again, when you're looking at it in a practical application perspective, those, you know, that person or that volunteer at the club is, of course, going to have roots in that community, roots within the club. So if something was to happen, that potentially puts that person in a very, you know, not a very positive, you know, space where maybe they go to school with the kid, like the kids go to school together or somebody knows somebody or whatever. So like, that's an example where I think, like, on one hand, you can say, oh, we have a safeguarding officer, everything's good. But then the practical application, you're like, well, again, maybe there's bias if they're, you know, within the same community. So like, from that perspective, I've suggested within our club, like, we should, you know, maybe, you know, partner up with a club from across the country that, so when, you know, if there's an issue, we go to that safeguarding person that lives in Bray, who knows nobody in Limerick, has no connections. And the perception from both sides is that that person's completely unbiased and also doesn't have any ramifications in their daily life if they make a decision that somebody within that community is not happy with. So I think, again, if we're really serious about getting these environments safe, like I said, I think there's great framework being done, but I do think absolutely there's still massive holes that need to be, you know, and I've said this even within, you know, when I first came forward within the blog that I wrote 5 years ago, like, what's the point of like talking about player development or national team accomplishments or anything if we don't even have the basics right in ensuring that every athlete coming through the soccer space in any country is safe, you know? And like I said, I think there's a real, real opportunity here for Ireland to be at the forefront to say, like, this is what an actual, you know, proper system looks like. This is how, you know, and having that humility to say, like, we don't, you know, we don't have all the answers. We don't have to have everything perfect. But, like, you know, we have a safeguarding weekend, you know, every year that, like, all the players go in and they're educated, like, what is grooming? What is neglect? Like, you know, what's proper treatment? You know, and this isn't about, like, oh, you know, Johnny's not getting playing time or whatever. It's again, like, making sure that, like, and again, also sort of, no one's going to be perfect, and having spaces that if people mess up, that, like, again, there's, you know, there's obviously variants of, you know, sort of, things that people can do, you know, and I'm not talking sex abuse versus like yelling at somebody is obviously two very different sides of the spectrum. But I just think the more aware even coaches, let's just say on the side of like yelling at players, like just to even, you know, have conversations around that and just build awareness of like what is a safe like sporting space. And again, the goal should be that like people come out of their sporting experiences better and it's a positive experience and it's something that helps their lives move forward in a great way as opposed to like 20 years after your, you know, career ends that you're, you know, broken from your experience and you don't want to see, you know, obviously that's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty serious experience that someone would have had to feel like that. But like, again, there's a lot of us that have had those experiences. And I just think at the end of the day, there's a real opportunity here to be just change makers and set a standard for like what an actual safe sport environment looks like, because I just think globally we're not there yet.
And also across sport as well, which seems like it might be unfortunately the next thing in this. Mark Tighe on the show last night suggesting that there is going to be further developments, but not necessarily within football. He did, however, also say that there were I think maybe around half a dozen uses of the anonymous hotline already from the FAI perspective. What I'm keen to know is how that hotline should operate from the standpoint of somebody who is making a complaint, like anonymity versus non-anonymity, and what then needs to happen afterwards in terms of caring for that individual. That whole process interests me in terms of how that should work.
Right. Well, I know, like, again, using our experience in Canada, you know, there was a quote unquote hotline set up. But then when we looked into it, the hotline was run by legal counsel of the organization. And again, you know, it was storefronted differently. So on the outside, it didn't look like it. But once we dug a little bit, that's what we came to the conclusion. So like, but that sums up Canada's response in a nutshell, right? Like it wasn't. So, I mean, I think that's the first step is obviously having true anonymity. I think another thing when we did call the hotline in Canada, it was like just the most sterile, non-empathetic person on the other side. So I think, again, with these hotlines, you need to have somebody there that's, yeah, trained in some capacity with trauma management or just even knows how to be an empathetic individual to a person that's reporting, because I think people have to recognize that to like actually come forward is a really brave step. And I think a lot of times too, we're like, you know, whether within the situations or within society or gaslit to sort of even question, is this a thing, or is this, you know, as serious as it feels to me or whatever. So, you know, I think also even to have someone on the other end that can say, yeah, you know what, this is a Garda issue, let, you know, I'll help you make that report, or this is the closest place. And then I think also, yeah, I mean, I think anonymity is important because some people, you know, whether they want to feel freely to be able to like give the information and not have their name attached to it, or, you know, that's obviously, there's ramifications when you come forward. And so I think that to make that, I think absolutely if somebody wants to be anonymous. And then, yeah, I mean, I think then you need to have, again, it's almost like you need to sort of segue people off in whatever direction their complaint is. And then I do think that absolutely like the care of that person afterwards, because I know for me in my situation, you know, when I came forward, it was only because there was a bunch of national team skiers from Canada that had come forward a few months before me. And one of my best friends used to ski for Canada. So she put me in touch with the whistleblower in the ski case. That became my lifeline for a month. Like that was, I've never even met her in person before. And she was like my person for a month that I like could go to, you know. And I mean, even for me, I've reached out to one of the women in the documentary who I've met through being here and stuff, and offered that, you know, just because I think that having that level again of sort of like your what you've experienced is valid. And I think when you have someone that reflects back that experience, so I just think really having that piece of it, and it is trauma, you know, like I can speak openly and say like I've gone to a lot of therapy for, you know, reconciling like my experience. And I think, you know, recognizing that like there is a lot of trauma in the sports system. And I'm sure with this hotline, there's going to be a lot of people coming forward. And again, if we're good people in a good society, you want to make sure those people are taken care of. And I really do hope that those, like all those organizations, you know, in the grand scheme of things, just to be good human beings, set up those sorts of supports, because those are things that, like I said, like we had a fight for in Canada, and it caused a lot of added harm that just was so unnecessary. You know, so like I said, I think the responses that I've seen so far are good in that capacity. And I just really do hope that all those individuals that both step forward in the documentary and that are stepping forward in hotlines, that they're given, like, not just, oh, hey, here's this random resource to go call this hotline, but like, hey, like, are you okay? And here's a therapist we've set up that you can go to just work through what obviously is coming out, because so much of this, as we could see in the documentary, people had pushed way down, including myself. You know, like when I came forward, I just cried for, like, you know, 2 years straight, randomly at times, just processing all of it, you know? And so, yeah, it's heavy, dark stuff. But like I said, I think there's a real opportunity here to really show the way. And like I said, I think the first steps have been really good, and I just hope it continues.
For sure, for sure. I think there's a lot in that that the FAI could take, and it might be a lot of new ground for a lot of the staff members who are working on this as well. But there is, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, a lot of expertise in this country about how things can be handled better with regards to other areas in this country and in other nations as well with regards to sport. Kira, thank you so much for coming in this morning. Thank you so much for bringing your own experiences to the table. Really appreciate it. You've been listening to Kira McCormack, who of course played for the Republic of Ireland but is currently CEO of Treaty United. We're going to be back tomorrow morning from 7:30 as ever. Myself and Aisling will be in studio. We'll chat to you then. Bye-bye.